You're listening to the Tin Can Phone Podcast on KBOO Portland.
You are listening to Tin Can Phone on KBOO Portland.
You're listening to the Tin Can Phone Podcast.
3 years in, three seasons in, I ain't talking that time. We was stuck in the pen, all the work they kept, all the work put in. Got it out the money, see the dirt on our hands. Pretty boy Poots had a dope ass plan. The recorder came in when Mike came in, so Tin Can Phone was contraband. Now you not, but still convicted, damn, they did our brother wrong. 12 on the yard and he walked that off, now Jaja's when he walk it out. KB packed like my cousin's house, but we ain't throwing hands, we talking it out. Bring your own blanket, we at grandma's house. It's Mike, it's Joe, it's Poots, it's me. We was out there yelling, free BG. It's Mike, it's Blue, it's Misfit Queez. Buddy in the cut, that's perfect scene. Tin Can Phone, that's something to see. I didn't do it, so I preach to the street, still praising the hood. Like I didn't lose Queef, Moon, Ben, and Billy too. When it comes to this life shit, but I'm cool. So every picture, I'm throwing up twos.
Well, welcome, audience. Thank you for coming. This is, I guess, in a technical sense, a recording of a Tin Can Phone episode. It is a part of the Policing Justice exhibition here at PICA, and a small feature of a project I worked on called Mapping the Pipeline, collaboration with Blue and several other collaborators. My name is master artist Michael Bernard Stevenson Jr., and we have a guest, Adrian Paul Alaron. Is that right?
No, it's pretty good, yeah.
All right, I'm French now. And so today, I should timestamp this. Today, we're looking into a few different segments. So for those of you who may stick around for the larger series, the Mapping the Pipeline installation is comprised of several different elements. And so this panel series, Day of Education, we'll be digging into different facets to kind of unpack some of the nuances within the work. So we're going to start off with some of the statistics research that was done and embedded into the larger installation. And then later we're going to sit with a student who is also a collaborator, particularly of this piece, and is a student at this school. But I actually worked with that student while he was a student at each of the schools in the installation. And then finally we'll be meeting with family of both Armand Pousse-Bassand and Derek Clark, who are being memorialized in this exhibition. So thanks for coming and sticking around. Adrian, welcome.
Hey.
How are you doing today?
Doing great. Sweet. Excited to be on my first podcast.
Yeah? This is your first? I'm giving you a lot of firsts.
I know.
First art exhibition, first podcast, maybe we'll do the first pole dancing class.
Ambitious.
First trip to Oregon City. Yeah, cool. Would you like to introduce yourself in any particular way?
Sure. My name is Adrian. I'm a colleague of Michael's. We both teach at Reed College, and I teach statistics. And through informal conversations with Michael, we realized that it would be interesting to provide some background statistical information to this exhibition. I think the initial idea was to look into carceral statistics, data about prisons in Portland and potentially the demographics of people that are incarcerated and their neighborhood of origins and things like that. Unfortunately, accessing this data was really challenging. There's a really long process that needs to be vetted. And we realized that actually it would take us more than the time that we had to just only access the data. So then the project shifted a little bit and we decided to look into some of the information that's, you know, publicly available, which is data from the U.S. Census Bureau that gives us information about the demographics and the socioeconomic status of individuals living in different parts of Portland. And we thought that could be an interesting background information for this exhibition.
Yeah, thank you for that. I've done a few tours of the exhibition, and it was funny because Adrian was on one of the tours and at the piece where most of Adrian's work is embedded, did a really excellent job of explaining it. And as you were talking about this, I realized, at least for the record and perhaps for some or all of the audience, to kind of contextualize the Mapping the Pipeline installation as it exists in this space are, I guess this is one of five or six islands I've been referring to them. They're kind of these chunks of a map pulled out of the Portland landscape. We are currently sitting at the Jefferson neighborhood site, which is in Northeast Albina, Northeast Portland, Northeast Albina. Other locations on the site are Harriet Tubman Middle School, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Elementary School. Right over here is Columbia River Correctional Institution. And for those of you who are less familiar with Tin Can Phone or this media project, we started all of this along with Queez, who's in the audience. Buddy, our producer, is documenting. And then Armand Pousse-Bassand, who's memorialized in this project, was kind of the origin point for this media enterprise, so to speak, recording interviews with several men at Columbia River Correctional Institution, which is the audio that's embedded in all of these islands. And then there's another site, Cottonwood School, which was really tied into the larger ethos of this exhibition, being a school site that's adjacent to an ICE facility that during 2020, when there was protests, a bunch of tear gas was used. And it's kind of, it's at the entrance of the exhibition, and its goal is to kind of set the initial spark of understanding this particular installation, Mapping the Pipeline, whereas as a society, we're poisoning the soil of primary school education sites. So when we're thinking about like what are the sources that are feeding into the youth community kind of headed through the prison to school pipeline, part of the way of understanding that is that we're not really holding the container of school well at all. And then there's another island in the front room, which is the Memorialization Island. It's being referred to as Beaverton, Tigard, and East of 82nd. And so essentially, Adrian's research charts the specifically Black residency in Albina and how, looking at census data, we can see over time how the displacement in that neighborhood has pushed folks outside of that particular region, which Cleo and Kane Talton Davis's work, as it's been playing in the background today, really well chronicles displacement, like an individual family's displacement in that neighborhood. And then the King Island over here is also kind of symbolically visualizing that with the cranes and apartment buildings in that neighborhood. And so that's the context for how Adrian's work was applied within this exhibition. That small island has several transparencies layering from 2000 to 22, the census data on Black residency in that community. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. Do you want me to start?
Yeah, let's do it. Why don't you dig in?
So I guess you touched upon the rationale for, you know, creating those visualizations, but I think one thing that could be pretty powerful when using demographic data is that you can, in a way, confirm with empirical evidence that's oftentimes seen as legitimate to people like policymakers or governments, things that people in the community have noticed and were able to see on their own, that the demographics of a neighborhood is changing. And oftentimes we talk about gentrification, although the concept is not necessarily well defined, but the idea here was at least to look at the data and see whether we saw a changing in the composition of the population of the Albina neighborhood. So how did we do this? I used data from the decennial census and the American Community Survey. And I wouldn't be a good statistician if I didn't talk a little bit about my sources. So the decennial census, you may be familiar with this. It happens every 10 years in the US. It's in the Constitution. So every 10 years, a bunch of survey interviewers knock at people's door and ask them a lot of information about their demographics, their health behaviors, their occupation, etc. And this is the primary source of statistical information about the US population. But because it happens every 10 years, in between those 10 years, there is a smaller sample of individuals that are asked the same exact questionnaire. But only 10 to 20% of them are asked this. And this is the American Community Survey, which allows us to have kind of continuous trends in between two different decennial censuses. And I'm going to stop there. I have a lot of thoughts on like this idea of doing a census every 10 years.
That's what this is for, man. Get it in there.
Well, the US is one of the last countries doing decennial censuses, one of the last Western countries doing decennial censuses. It's known to be a really bad way of collecting information about individuals, mostly because people that work are more likely to not be at home when the survey person comes and the US Census Bureau person comes and knocks at their door. Crowded households are more likely to be missed as well. The most recent decennial census was kind of a nightmare because it happened during COVID, and Donald Trump had mentioned this idea to ask a question about citizenship, which obviously scared a lot of people. And so a lot of people didn't open the door when the US Census Bureau person came, although the question was actually removed beforehand, which means that the data was probably one of the worst census in recent years. And it had a direct impact on the representation of a lot of folks, especially in California, where a lot of seats were lost for parliament because the number of seats that are allocated to each areas based on the number of people that live there. So that's why it's like in the Constitution, like each person needs to be measured in order to be represented. But unfortunately, a decennial census is not the best practice to do this. Using a survey with a probability sampling is likely a better idea. There was a debate in the late 90s as to whether drop the decennial census altogether and switch to a just use the American Community Survey exclusively. And there were really, you know, high level conversation at the Supreme Court wondering whether Thomas Jefferson, when he was in France, potentially had met Laplace, the inventor of the surveys, of the probability sample surveys, and had a conversation with him in Paris, let's say in like 1770 or something, and therefore had been aware of the concept of probability sample. And therefore, using a survey instead of the census would be okay. And then they ruled out this possibility that they had actually met. And therefore, we stick with the decennial census, which has known drawbacks.
It's funny. This isn't the first time this has happened for me, where I'm like learning about like American history from a non-American person. So I was like, oh, that's my favorite source is the French. But then you gave an excellent example of why it would come from there. But this is all really helpful. And this is, it's helpful in more than one way. I think this exhibition is really interesting because it, more than most art exhibitions, is like really full of like detailed statistical and factual information embedded with like artistic representation, which is relatively rare in the art world. I'm looking at them, so it seems like it makes sense to say like Sandy Rodriguez's work, you know, uses like handmade paper and pigments that are like mined from different areas, and that information may exist, but it isn't necessarily contained within the work. And that's one of the kind of impetuses I had normally in my work, which is often highly symbolic. It's without this kind of statistical foundation that allows the symbolic representation to be backed up by like scientific concern. And so it's also interesting, at least in my own work. I mean, I do learn things from places, but I find in my creative work and collaborations, I learn deeply into a topic that I wouldn't otherwise know. And particularly the format of Tin Can Phone allows the things that I learn to be broadcast to an audience for additional consumption learning and hopefully impact. I think when I was initially curated into this exhibition, one of the comments by the curators was that there was a hope that this would like influence voting turnout and participation. And I had responded, I said, you know, I'm an artist and I don't really know that I believe art does that. I tell this story a lot that when I was young, you know, you learn about Diego Rivera and, or I mean, other plenty of artists, which is the example I use where like they kind of painted the revolution into happening. And then as you learn more about the art world, you realize that artists are just like living and working around events in history that happen. And they didn't necessarily like summon the thing from their paintbrush. They were perhaps participating, and if not, then just observing something happening and creating depictions around it, which are appreciated within the movement, but they aren't necessarily making the movement occur. And so is a reason why my work has become more socially engaged, is the intention to actually like be a part of the engine of the change. But I have yet, this is the first instance of my practice where collaborating with data scientists and other folks who are working within the field of observation. And I guess even before you get into presenting your hard research, I'm curious, you know, is this in what way? Well, I guess I finished the sentiment, which is to say, I'm excited in my own work to have been able to have these collaborations influence the way that the visual artwork is seen, perceived, and accessed by a viewer. And then I'll say my question to you is this a new form for your own participation? And do you feel like your work traditionally is observational and less applied, whether or not this is applied or not, but that like the nature of your work, do you feel like it gets applied and it causes influence, or is it more observational? And did this work feel like it, due to it having a platform different from the traditional way that you practice?
I didn't realize that was going to be asked tough questions. So,
what is happening? This is Tin Can Phone's Misfit Audi. Tin Can Phone podcast airing every first Tuesday of the month on K-Boo Radio. It's important for you to donate, for Tin Can Phone is the only way for the ones inside to hear us and to get their voices from the inside out. Tin Can Phone is that pipeline. It's also important for you to donate because K-Boo is a community radio, so therefore needs your support, needs your help. K-Boo is built and ran by the community itself. Now, to donate, you can go to kboo.fm/give. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Or on your mobile app, you can hit the donate button on the mobile app right off of your phone. And you can text KBOO to 44321. If you ain't got the app, text KBOO to 44321. And if you're a little old school and like to use the mail, hey, KBOO at 20th Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Again, you can mail it to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. 10 Can Gang, Misfit Audi, KBOO Radio. When?
I'm going to say
just be at ease. Just be at ease.
I think most of the research in general, like academic research, and I don't want to lose my job, so I'm going to mince my words, but I think a lot of it is performative. Like you just kind of write articles because it's the currency in academia. So that's definitely observational. I'm lucky enough that like oftentimes I get to present my results to like governments, and like most of my research is not in the US, but oftentimes I get to talk to people that care about the data that they collected because it was a lot of efforts and they just want to essentially have a way of visualizing it as you will today on maps, as opposed to just, you know, long Excel lines in an Excel spreadsheet. And I think maps is a really easy way of like relating to things because space is really intuitive to us. But otherwise, I think the most impactful type of work that I can do is probably just like through teaching and like teaching students to get that information as easily as it is. Actually, the information is readily available, as I will show shortly, and we're just oftentimes not aware of it. So like learning techniques for them to become more empowered to just have access to this information and like display it themselves, I think is probably the most impactful. And obviously I'm really excited for this. And we've talked about kind of pursuing this and like maybe bringing it to a next level. And I would be really excited for this, but I'm already really excited for, you know, what has happened so far.
Yeah, and we'll dig into that stuff, what you prepared, in a moment. But one of the things I continue to stress, and I feel like perhaps, so again, when invited to participate in the exhibition, most of my work occurs in community. And so these sculptures, which is a harken back to my like undergraduate practice, and something I personally enjoy. So when invited to participate, I was intentional about making a proposal for something that I would enjoy creating. But these islands are essentially hosts for series of information and documentation that are the results of community work. So the reason for this addition or segue is to say that Adrian and I applied for monies from Reed College to bring on a student, which also pinging their comment about teaching and the value of that is core to my own practice, which is to say that I'm thinking about the school to prison pipeline. One of the best ways to divert that flow of human presence is to like provide knowledge, education, access, resources. And so I'm working with Noni, who's a local, or I'm getting ready to work with Noni, who does a youth program of local Black young people who, she took interest in this installation and the statistics, and so it's actually a great site to take our work with a young person at Reed to try to activate, you know, like, I think one of the reasons I'm raising this up as well is because I think when people come and look at these sculptural installations, they're experiencing the most inert part of my practice, as well as, you know, I've had a conversation with a faculty at Jefferson who, when they came and they saw the statistics on suspension, they were kind of disturbed. They felt like it was like a negative representation of the institution. And I felt that was really important to touch base on. So now I'm benefited by recently having had a conversation with them earlier this week where I helped to, they didn't really marry the different sites together and like take in the whole piece, where the whole thing was trying to illustrate like a flow, a human flow, more than it was to like antagonize any individual institution as being good or bad. But all of these houses here, as an example, were made by students at Jefferson. And we did a workshop with Molly Esteve, who's an architect at Brick Architecture. They came, we went outside and took photos of houses within the neighborhood. And then they learned SketchUp, created the model. They were printed at Reed College and now are part of this installation. And I paid them to be a part of that workshop. And so they're able to put both the workshop on their resume, being a part of this exhibition on their resume. They learned skills, they were compensated for their time. And so that is really important for me to be a part of my work and for it to be a part of the exhibition. And I think that maybe I didn't do a good job of like making that clear when I'm not standing there explaining it. So when you brought that up, I felt like it was important to also contextualize as a part of this, that this research is not just to like point at an issue, but it is to leverage even the collection of it to educate folks about their current situation and, you know, give them tools in which to interact, manipulate, and engage. Do you want to dig in?
Yeah. So one last piece of information about the data sources. All the data that will be presented at the census tract level, which doesn't really overlap with any, you know, human conception of a neighborhood. It's just essentially a rectangle that the census draws just to make it manageable to go to every single household and knock on their doors. There are even lower levels at which the information is available, but oftentimes you cannot use the demographic information at the block level because of anonymity or because of hiding the identity of people. Like, it would be easy to guess who is making a certain amount of money and has a certain demographics. So which metrics are we going to focus on? We're going to look into median household income. So when you're looking at the census tract, how much is making the household that's, you know, right in the middle of this distribution, which is kind of an idea of the average person in a census tract. And then within each census tract, the percentage of people that respond to the demographic question in the census saying that they are Black. So why these two metrics? I guess the first one is oftentimes used as a good indicator for changes in like the socioeconomic status of people living in a neighborhood. And at first, we were thinking of maybe looking at this alone, but the goal being to see whether population was displaced. And, you know, a possible counter-argument would be, well, everyone in this neighborhood really just got richer. Like, what we're seeing is just that everyone just got much wealthier. But combining this with a demographic indicator, like the proportion of people that identify as Black, show that it's not really a possible explanation for what's happening. So here is a first kind of like quantitative results. So here I'm just looking at distributions, comparing all the census tracts in Albina in dark blue, in navy blue, and then all the census tracts in the rest of Portland. And so if we look at first the distribution in 2009, you see that it's centered around the same point here, $80,000 in both parts of the city. But obviously there are census tracts of Portland, especially in the western part of the city in Northwest, where the median household income already in 2009 was really high, around 150K per year. And then there's a lot of variation. So in some census tracts, it's much less, but the mode was around $80,000. And then if we look at the distribution in Albina, you see that there are a couple of census tracts where the median household income was a bit higher, almost 100K. And we'll see which census tract we're talking about here in a minute. And then we see that there are also a good amount, so like a second little mode here where a good amount of census tracts where the median household income is substantially lower. And then if we look at the evolution over time, you see that progressively the mode of this distribution among Albina will actually surpass the rest of Portland. And by 2022, we see that the spread in Portland is much larger. So there are census tracts in the rest of Portland that are still much richer than any census tract within Albina. And there are still census tracts within the rest of Portland that are still much poorer than any census tract in Albina. But if we look at the middle of the distribution, on average, if you just pick up a census tract in Albina, odds are that it's going to be much richer than a census tract in the rest of Portland, which really wasn't the case in 2009, where those two distributions were essentially overlapping in their mode. So already we have kind of an indication of a significant change in household income. And more importantly, because just, you know, because of inflation, we expect median household income to increase over time, but more importantly, an increase that was much faster across census tracts of Albina than the rest of Portland. So this first distribution, you don't really have any geographic aspect of it. We're just looking at how census tracts compared in Albina in the rest of Portland. So next, I'm just showing you a map of Portland. Each little polygons represents those census tracts that I was mentioning. On the right-hand side, you have the whole city of Portland. On the left-hand side, you have a zoom on those census tracts that are within the historical boundaries of the Albina neighborhood. And so if we look at 2009, the picture is pretty clear. The richest neighborhoods of Portland are on, you know, the northwest here, and to a lesser extent in the southwest. And then the eastern part of the river is not as wealthy, although there is this one census tract that you can see that's already pretty wealthy within the neighborhood of Albina. But you also have a couple of census tracts in the neighborhood that are actually quite close to here, where the median household income is $20,000 to $40,000 a year. And so arguably not that much. If we go to 2015, we see that The picture hasn't changed so much yet, but overall, what we see at the city level is that they're starting to be richer, census tracts that are on average richer in this kind of like middle part of the eastern side of the river. And regarding Albina specifically, we see that the eastern part of Albina, so those eastern census tracts, the one that was already quite wealthy in 2009 is still really wealthy, more than 150K a year is the median household income in this census tract. And then you see that the one directly adjacent to it are also getting quite wealthy. And then in 2022, the picture has kind of completely changed compared to 2009, where if you remember, it was really only the left bank or the western side of Portland that was including the richest census tracts. Now you see that those census tracts are kind of all over the eastern part of the river as well. And specifically, if we focus on Albina, you see a lot more census tracts that are among the richest in the whole city of Portland. And there are only a few remaining census tracts within the historical neighborhood of Albina that are, you know, lower income. So this big shifts that we were seeing in the distribution, we can see it on the maps as well here, where we see a much larger diversity of median wealth in a really close proximity in the neighborhood of Albina compared to 2009, where there was a relative homogeneity in income. Moving on to the next metric of interest. So obviously one possible explanation for this is that essentially gentrification happened between 2009 and 2022, and a lot of people were displaced and a lot of people with higher income replaced them in those neighborhoods. Another explanation would be that everyone that lived in Albina in 2009 got much wealthier. And so one way to investigate this question is to just look at the demographics of individuals living in this neighborhood to see whether we see a displacement of a population or and maybe something that would be in line with just the population getting richer. So again, my little distributions here. So you see that in 2009, if I look at Albina, the census tracts in Albina, at least 10% of the population in a census tract was identifying as Black, and up to 40% in certain census tracts. And then, you know, the middle of the distribution was around 25%. So the census tracts that were included in the neighborhood of Albina were between 10% to 40% Black, with a peak around, so most of them were around 20 to 30% Black. If we compare this to the rest of the city, well, you see that there's almost no overlap in those two distributions, which means that essentially the rest of the city was essentially non-Black at all. Like, there were almost no Black residents in the rest of Portland, apart from those, like a few census tracts right here. But otherwise, like the main, most of the census tracts had between 0 and 5% of the population that were Black residents. And then as we progress through times, we see that the proportion of Black residents within Albina, this distribution shifts to the left, which means that on average, each census tract has lost a lot of its Black population. And you see that in 2022, now the most common census tract is a census tract with about 15% of the population that's Black, as opposed to 25 to 30% previously in 2009. So in really short time lapse, you see a huge decrease in the proportion of Black residents across the census tracts in Albina. And we're going to look at a map to kind of visualize this. So if you look at the map in 2009, it's pretty clear that if you look at this map, darker shades of purple mean a higher proportion of the population that's Black. So if you just take the whole population in the census tract and you just take the whole population that identifies as Black, you divide it by the number of people in this census tract, it gives you the percentage. So one out of three person in most of those census tracts was Black. And then as you go lighter colors, it means that it's just that there are really few Black residents in those census tracts. And so you see that it's really concentrated in Albina. And then this census tract that's around the airport. And the rest of the city is really not, has really few Black residents. And then progressing through time, we see that this starts to change a little bit. So first of all, in 2015, you have lesser, the proportion of Black residents in Albina is much smaller, and you start to see higher proportion in the eastern part of the city. And by 2022, you see that most of the census tracts in the historical Black neighborhood of Albina are actually less than 10% Black. Some of them are 10 to 20% Black. And then actually the census tracts that have the largest proportions of Black residents are now in the eastern part of the city, and the northern census tracts, so the one at the airport, and then maybe like more west of that as well. So just kind of looking at these two maps next to one another, it's pretty clear that the census data kind of confirm some of the intuitions that people have as to, you know, the changes in the neighborhood, that it's much wealthier and much wider than it used to be, and also that a lot of people have moved in the eastern neighborhoods of Portland, so east of that highway that, is it 205?
82nd.
82nd?
Or I guess maybe it's 205, but also the divide is kind of the street of 82nd.
Right, so a lot of people have likely moved east of 82nd, and that this hypothesis that we had initially, that potentially the increase in median household income was just reflecting people becoming richer, is not really validated with when we look at the demographic data as well. So I just have a few conclusions point, but really we can talk about anything.
What is happening? This is Tin Can Phones, Misfit Adi. Tin Can Phone Podcast, airing every first Tuesday of the month on KBOO Radio. It's important for you to donate, for Tin Can Phone is the only way for the ones inside to hear us and to get their voices from the inside out. Tin Can Phone is that pipeline. It's also important for you to donate because KBOO is a community radio, so therefore needs your support, needs your help. KBOO is built and ran by the community itself. Now, to donate, you can go to kboo.fm/give. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Or on your mobile app, you can hit the donate button on the mobile app right off of your phone. And you could text KBOO to 44321. If you ain't got the app, text KBOO to 44321. And if you're a little old school and like to use the mail, hey, KBOO at 20th. Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Again, you can mail it to KBOO at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Tin Can Gang, Misfit Adi, KBOO Radio. When?
You're holding your conclusions. Is that what you're saying?
They're just not necessarily so relevant, and we can just talk about it.
Sure.
Like this.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I was thinking about for a while now is that, I mean, when we met, you mentioned that a lot of your use of census data was related to health. And so this was like a little bit of like a shift in focus, but mirroring in practice. And so I'm also, though, curious because both as a non-American born person, but you know, a lot of my own getting to learn the albino community has been through research and engagement. So I'm curious what it was like to, I don't know if you had any basis for what the history or culture of albino or the northern northeastern region or the history of black people in Portland, but what it was like to kind of like dig through in this way. Big hard questions.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I don't feel like really knowledgeable about the history of this city. And I feel like I'm much more knowledgeable now than I was 9 months ago, but I'm missing a lot of nuances for sure.
Sure.
And I was just really surprised to see how quickly all of these demographic shifts happen. It's not uncommon to see, you know, profound changes in the socioeconomic composition and the demographic composition of neighborhoods in a city when looking at granular levels, but this really accelerated in the 2010s, and we don't have, so the American Community Survey is conducted every year, but because it's a small sample, when we analyze data, the census tract, we have to aggregate them over 5 years. So that's why I present the results for 2009, 2015, and 2022. And so because those data are average over 5 years, it tends to smooth what's happening truly. And so it's hard to precisely date when things change, but they definitely accelerated around 2015 to 2018. And I was really surprised and shocked to see how quickly the population changed around that time. I think it's pretty remarkable. Usually we're talking about things that happen over, you know, a couple decades, and this happened probably within 5 years.
And while you were saying that, it's interesting, and again, I too have an outsiderness to this, so it's pretty fascinating to me. In my own navigation through the neighborhood and community, my initial access point is not, how do I say this? When I engage in the community, a lot of what I get is stories. I feel like I know more about Portland than I do about where I was born and raised. like cultural history and movement, all of those things, whether it be the amount of story that I've been able to listen to, access, or seek out, as well as at this point engaging in different like historical presentations, research and archives, and then now like statistical data mining. But so what I'm about to say is relatively unscientific or is covering a wide swath, but it's interesting in conversation with you. I don't even know how much we've talked about these things and explicitly. So anyway, something I've been thinking about lately is essentially Albina was formed while everyone fled from Vampur. Have we talked much about this?
A little bit.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's interesting to think about like what would the census data look like, because you're like, oh, this happened in about 5 years' time. And so everyone from Vampur, and then that was like several decades of like building and thriving Black neighborhood and community. And then again, kind of more linked to Cleo's installation in collaboration with others, there was the era of, and is contextualized much at the Tubman site in my installation, the building of I-5 and the Legacy Emmanuel campus, which both happened, you know, I think in like the, between the 20s and 40s. And so it's curious, a lot of the damage to the neighborhood's residential composition had occurred way before even this data, the sample size of data that we're using. And so as you were talking, and it's interesting because like in my periphery or behind you is the King Neighborhood Island site, which one of the primary representations that is, to me, in Albina, one of the most visible spaces of a shift. I remember one time I was taking a picture of something and this guy was walking across the street and he goes like, "That's nothing. You should have seen it 20 years ago." Black gentleman. And so it's just super fascinating. I think that particular street is richly, visibly gentrified. But again, it was super interesting when you were talking, because I was like, I guess I'll pose it as a question, because you had said before that there isn't like a great definition of gentrification. But also recently, we went on a bike ride, and then the following day or so, you said that you like biked around that neighborhood. So I'm curious, after doing all of this research, what did moving through that region look and feel like to you? Like, did you notice any home? I mean, you had never been there even before, right? Like, had you visited that neighborhood before you did any of this research?
Not really.
Right. No. So that's why it's interesting, right? Like, you are like granularly aware of the past few decades of that region. And then you were just there. Like, you might be there without having done this research and be like, oh, this is how this place is. Maybe it was always like this. But you knew that's not true. So, you know, what did you see and feel that, you know, how did you marry those two perceptions of what you knew statistically and what you were seeing?
Well, interestingly enough, and maybe this is completely wrong, but biking through that part of the neighborhood that you're mentioning that's really close to here, I guess it's up Vancouver Avenue or something like this. Or no, yeah, or like up
Williams.
I was really reminded of Oakland, actually, in the sense that like a lot of like businesses are really similarly brand new. And I guess I visited Oakland not so long ago, but I guess the difference is that the demo, like the racial and ethnic composition of Oakland is really different from this neighborhood.
Right.
So I guess like there was a clear contrast in my mind there. But otherwise, yeah, in terms of like the history, I knew little of it before starting doing this research. And I think one piece of like extending this project would be to look at census data way before what we started looking into. So we started in 2000 for ease of comparisons, because the census tracts change every 10 years. By definition, if the population increases or decreases, they're redrawn. And so just aligning the geography of those census tracts was pretty easy for 2000, 2010, and 2020. But then if you go back before that for 1990s and then all this, you know, all the censuses that were conducted throughout the 20th century, then it actually requires much more work of like trying to map the census tracts together. And so it's much harder to look at a long time series of what was happening. But it is possible. I think it just requires more time. And I think that would be quite exciting to look at, for instance, changes in demographic compositions throughout Portland from, you know, 1945 to today. Or something like that.
Right. Interesting. Well, I feel sated in, well, I guess I feel sated in that, like, now this is a part of the archive. I mean, we've had these conversations several times, but it's kind of like sand running through your fingers. Like, the amount of things that you say and understand in a complex way. Again, both of us are like outsiders to this region, but it's also interesting, like, the data that you put together and created, it doesn't just exist, right? Like, I have conversations with people who are local to this neighborhood and region, and I'm not, they never said, like, you know, when I asked them about maps, they gave me like these historical maps, like physical space drawings. Like, I don't know if there is, at least not public, which, you know, as I'm saying this, I'm like, oh, I should, I've been low capacity since finalizing the installation. But I think that's why Noni is interested in this, because it's not charted. You know, I remember running into an article that mentioned that the shift in Black population in Albina is like rapidly shifting within the past 2 to 5 years, but it didn't present it comprehensively in this way. So all that said, I feel sated that now a part of the archive is this, because again, as it is in the installation, and it's interesting every time I visit that initial island with folks on the tour, they're like interested for a moment, but the depth of this, and even that packet that's next to the thing, it has like the residential and then the income, which we talked about, but then also like rent burdenness. So I think it's in general really exciting for me in my own practice to be able to link these statistical data sets to, I like, I guess, making painting analogies when talking about art, but these broad strokes within my work, because, you know, again, it's why I veered in a socially engaged direction, because I felt like making broad strokes about a premise was not doing it for me. So to that end, I'm appreciating this conversation and for getting it kind of on the record. And I guess, unless there's specific conclusions you want to lay out, I'll see if anyone has questions.
Yeah, that works.
Does anyone have a question? The question is, if the Black families leaving are more homeowners or renters?
So that's definitely something that's recorded in the census and in the American Community Survey. It's not something that we looked at. Whenever you're trying to cross more than one characteristics of a household, so here in this case, it would be two, the granularity at which you can look into that decreases. So you have to go at more coarse geographic level to analyze more specific variables just for avoiding people to be identified through the analysis. That's definitely a really interesting question. And I think that's something we could investigate by looking at just the little comparisons that I was doing between all the census tracts within Albina and the rest of Portland. That would be an analysis that would be possible, not by census tracts. I would need to group data together to look into that. But I think that's something that would be really interesting to look into. Maybe some gist of like that could be found in looking at home property value and how it has changed over time, which is something that I think is printed at the island over there. And, you know, we see that home property value just increases a lot over time in Portland, but also specifically like at a faster pace in Albina. So this indicates to me that there's been a lot of houses sold, but this could also mean that there were renters and big housing projects were destroyed and replaced with like fancy apartments. So it's, yeah, we need to like cross the information to be able to answer that question.
And to my understanding, you know, there has historically been a lot of Black home ownership. And then during this 10, 15, 20, 30 year cycle, if we like reverse the trends of median income, and it's interesting, there's an organization locally called Taking Ownership, which folks who continue to own houses, Black folks who continue to own houses in that region, some in things have like fallen into disrepair. And if we also think about that in a certain way, like if someone's aging in that space, you know, their ability to care for their own home kind of diminishes with their mobility, et cetera, whether it's also income related or not. And so, but a lot of folks, I think in the boom and in the shift, right, did sell, because it was an opportunity for them to shift generational wealth in their own family, while a lot of folks stayed if they could. And I think like within the data sets that we're looking at, I would assume that a lot of that is actually rentership. It is an assumption, But I think, again, like when we're looking at the era of the building of I-5 and Legacy Emmanuel, that was a lot of black home ownership that was through eminent domain reversed. And one of the pieces in this exhibition is a lot about a property that Cleo's family owned, and the house on it was red tagged. And so similar to redlining, it was like a form of political executive power in which to like make decisions about the property. And so they essentially red tagged the house, and it was considered like unfit for residence. And so they demolished the home, but the property remained theirs. And the ethos around that artwork is that due to that political injustice, he was able to appeal to the state in which to have a different historical home moved onto the property. It is now kind of being built as an archive space for the neighborhood. So yeah, again, is interesting to dig deeper into. So yeah, I guess something for our future statistical realm. Well, thank you for your time. Thank you for coming on your weekend to be a part of this presentation. And I'm looking forward to continuing to unpack this with you.
Thank you, Michael.
Woo! You're listening to the Tin Can Phone podcast here at KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Listen every single first Tuesday of every month at 10 a.m. or you can stream this at kboo.fm/tincanphone. Tune in at kboo.fm or 90.7 FM for more show.